Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring guest speaker Dr. Gulnaz Sharafutdinova. We're grateful to her and to everyone who's joined us online today. I'm Bill Reisinger, an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. Before we get started, let me express ICFRC's gratitude to its annual donors, members, sponsors, and partners for their support. The list includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxes Plus, and City Channel 4 for providing online access to ICFRC's programs, along with the UI Library Archives. ICFRC has adopted the Native American Land Acknowledgement, prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Human Rights Commission. ICFRC recognizes that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homelands of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. The full text of ICFRC's acknowledgement is on our website at icfrc.org. As we get started, I would like to cover some Zoom etiquette. Please keep your audio turned off for the duration of the presentation so you do not interrupt the speaker. If you want to keep your video on, we ask that you do your best not to use any distracting movements or behaviors. Following our speaker's formal remarks at about 12:45 p.m., we will have a 15-minute Q&A. You will be able to submit your questions via the chat function. At that time, we encourage you to turn on your video, but please keep your audio muted to avoid any background noise. I would now like to introduce Dr. Gulnaz Sharafutdinova. She is professor of Russian politics and director of the Russia Institute at King's College London. Born in Tatarstan, Russia, she got her PhD from George Washington University and previously taught at Miami University in Ohio. I got to know her in the 2000s when we were both conducting research on politics in Russia's subnational regions. Through a series of work, she provided key insights into how the Putin leadership transformed Russia's federal system and tamed the governors who had been such a thorn in Boris Yeltsin's side. More recently, she has concentrated on understanding Russia's attachment to Putin and how Russians have come to see themselves and the country they belong to in a particular way. Her book on this topic, The Red Mirror, Putin's Leadership and Russia's Insecure Identity, came out from Oxford University Press in 2020. I recommend it highly to anyone interested in Russia today. It's clearly written and full of telling details. Gulnaz has also a forthcoming book from Bloomsbury Press entitled The Aftermath of Soviet Man, Rethinking Homo Sovieticus. With tomorrow being the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we couldn't be more fortunate than to have her with us today to share her insights. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Gulnaz Sharafutdinova, who will speak on From Victimhood to Aggression, Russia's Path to War Against Ukraine. Gulnaz?
Thank you so much, Bill. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you for your wonderful introduction. And it's a pleasure and honor to share the insights of the intellectual path I've gone through with this book, The Red Mirror, to share with the ideas that have developed over time that started developing at least around 2014 or even earlier. So hopefully by the end of the presentations, all the listeners will get some coherent lens through which to, one possible lens through which to understand what's happening in Russia with the population, with the leadership, with its failed democratic attempt trajectory, and with all the tragedy, trouble, mess, and problems that have emerged in that part of the world. I think I'm sharing, okay, and I need to move this. Okay, I want to just, let me just note that the book, I'm a political scientist by training, but I've also come with all my association at Miami University in Ohio, at Heidegger Center, I've come to a real strong appreciation of interdisciplinary knowledge creation. And if in the earlier career I have relied a lot, and in political science we all do rely on economics as a role model, around 2014 it was pretty clear that the tools, our analytical tools that we use, are not quite able to explain what was happening in that part of the world. And since around 2014, my intellectual trajectory led me in the direction of adopting some new insights from social psychology. So that's why I want to just sort of notify how political science could be enriched by different disciplines, and how we political scientists rely on history, on psychology, on social psychology, on economics for our inspiration. And so the Red Mirror is a result of this enrichment and inspiration that came from social psychology. So before laying out the main arguments and some of the just maybe some snippets about the methods that have gone into this study, let me introduce you to what we can refer to as a Russian paradox or a puzzle. How around 2014, if you look at this red line, the very top point of that red line is around July, August 2014, summer 2014, 6-7 months into the time when Russia annexed Crimea. March 16 was the referendum that was held in Crimea, and when Crimea was, you know, Crimeans voted and Russia adopted them as part of the Russian territory. So when this happened, in the West, the public was looking at these events, of course, with a big sense of worry. And, you know, imagine someone comes into your house and occupies a sunroom in your house or a conservatory in your house, you know, the one with the garden door. And that's pretty much what happened with Crimea and Russia's occupation of Crimea in Ukraine. This was the first unprecedented shift change in territorial boundaries that that occurred through force. It didn't involve bloodshed, but it did occur through force. And so while in the West, people, observers, the media were thinking about what this means about Russia's growing authoritarianism, aggression, expansion, while the neighbors of Russia, other neighbors, Kazakhstan, Belarus, the Baltic states, were getting more and more worried, what happens in Russia itself, in the society? Well, what happens in Russia itself was that people were growing more and more optimistic and even euphoric. It took a name, a concept of post-Crimea euphoria. And this red graph captures the essence of this euphoria, because the FCIOM surveys and surveys by Levada Center showed that in summer 2014, the Russian society, Russian people, found themselves at record high sense of optimism, a sense of well-being that is expressed in this happiness index. So as the world was getting more and more worried about what's happening in that part of the world, Russians themselves were actually getting happier. Now, if we look at this other graph, which is the graph of GDP growth, then you see that this rising happiness was actually happening at the time when the economy, Russian economy, was doing worse and worse. We saw stagnation kicking in around 2013. And after 2014, this is the point that captures the beginning of new Western sanctions against Russia. The economic growth falls. And so you have this interesting paradox that people are getting happier while the economy is getting worse. And you know, I just want to show this graph to show it in a stark format what was happening. And from an outsider's perspective, this was certainly something very puzzling and in need of explanation. I was born and raised in the Soviet Union. I have kept very close ties to the family and to, you know, people on the ground in Russia. And it was a puzzle to me, and it was an intellectual a challenge for me to understand. So what's happening in the society in Russia? Why, while the worries about Putin, Putinism, authoritarianism are growing, people are actually really liking what's happening, and Putin's popularity at that moment has risen from low 60s to upper 80s, even up until 86-89%. So my first attempt to explain this puzzle, this paradox, actually started with the concept of Homo Sovieticus, and many of you might be familiar with this concept if you have lived through some years in the Cold War. Homo Sovieticus is a concept that captures the analysis of many observers within these countries about how totalitarian system, how communism can impact individual psychology and individual behavior. So it started with the work, the title of the book, Captive Mind by Czesław Miłosz, a Polish Nobel Prize winning poet who first worked for the communist system in Poland for a few years before he realized how stifling and totalitarian and unopen to freedom it was. And after he was able to leave Poland in 1951, he found himself in France, where he wrote this book, Captive Mind, where he analyzed what it is in the system that attracts people, that attracts intelligentsia, intellectuals, etc. But besides Captive Mind, in the 70s and 80s, a number of books were written by dissidents from Eastern European countries, from Bulgaria, from Soviet Union, people like Georgi Markov and Alexander Zinoviev, who also, you know, put some efforts into developing these observations about how Soviet system or Stalinism or totalitarianism changes, interferes with individual level psychology. In the late Soviet period, Yuri Levada, a Soviet sociologist, who during perestroika was given resources and power and influence to establish new research programs, created an empirical foundation for this concept of Homo Sovieticus, which he referred to as Soviet men. And new surveys were held, and a book was written called Simple Soviet Men that went through building an empirical case to this concept of Homo Sovieticus. So I was thinking, yeah, perhaps the Soviet experience has something to do with how there are various cognitive, mental, or psychological patterns from the Soviet period that might be influencing how Russians are reacting to Putinism today. That was my first idea and hypothesis. And I have to say, I did write, so the book that is released today, actually, The Afterlife of the Soviet Men, Rethinking Homo Sovieticus, is speaking to and unearthing that Cold War intellectual histories of people who were engaged with this concept. But my earlier article also spoke to the debate on the Soviet men. And my very quick conclusion about this concept was that the analytical foundations of the concept, and I looked at the theories that Yuri Levada himself was driven by, are actually quite outdated. They relied on systems theory that was designed, constructed by an American sociologist, Talcott Parsons, in the late 50s and early 60s. Now, American sociology and political science have long moved away from systems theory, which was criticized on various grounds, but Levada was able to use it only in the late 80s. The interesting thing is that the Levada Center today is still using these concepts and still using these analytical underpinnings. So in a way, many of sociological observations and surveys are underpinned by rather old understanding of how things work between political system and individuals and things like that. Nonetheless, despite my findings, there were a number of people who tried to develop this line of theorizing. And Masha Gessen, a Russian journalist, she wrote a book, The Future is Russia, where she brought Levada's concept of Soviet man as an important explanatory variable. And then other political scientists have written books about how Soviet communist system interacts with post-communist attitudes at the public level. So that line of argumentation is alive. However, it was not so enlightening for me after a closer look at what's happening with the concept and with what went into that concept. So where I found inspiration is in social psychology that I mentioned earlier. And I have to share this wonderful, beautiful quote from an English poet, John Donne, that captures the essence, sort of intuitively, the essence of social identity theory. And he said, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main, right? So capturing this intrinsic sociality of an individual. And social identity theory that was started developing in the 70s. It's not a very new theory. It has gone through ebbs and flows. And it really focuses on how group membership, right? How every individual has a personal self, something that distinguishes, makes him unique from everyone else, and also a collection of social selves that are defined by our group membership. And whatever group we belong to, whether it's a large national group, a smaller or large religious group, a smaller group of professional affiliation, whether we are students, political scientists, you know, workers in a specific factory, or politicians, or whether we might have certain preferences for sports, you know, sports fans in various sports. So that group membership, each of them is really important for an individual's psychological well-being, because it provides us a sense of belonging, it provides us a sense of meaning and purpose in life, and it also plays an important role in underpinning individual self-esteem. And this social identity theory was used more recently. So I mentioned that the theory itself was pretty old, but it was used more recently to explain leadership and what leadership is. So to develop a specific theory of leadership. But before going into that, let me also note that within this theory, something that helped me to think about Russian predicament was a differentiation between secure and insecure identity. So social psychologists basically looked at this continuum. It's not a black and white thing, but it's more of a continuum that collective identities that we have, the social identities, could be more or less stable. Sometimes our belonging to a specific group, our sense of belonging, might seem threatened by when compared to other groups. So for example, you thought that, you know, belonging to or supporting this sports team that had been winning all the time, but all of a sudden your team started losing. So compared to other groups, that changeability in intergroup status and relationships becomes a source of insecurity for that social identity, right? So it's more applicable, more intuitive when we think about country belonging, our citizenship. When, you know, imagine today, for example, for US citizens, right, with the rise of China, that insecures a sense of belonging to the United States, because there is this rising power, and maybe all the power and the sort of hegemony that's been observed, the domination of American, say, values or capital or whatnot, is under threat. That insecures, certainly we see it on the political level, how it insecures politicians and their thinking. And so this differentiation between secure and insecure identity was very important for understanding of Russia, because, and you can imagine, because the country underwent a major collapse of the Soviet Union. It lost, you know, the country, people lost the country they belonged to. So, and then if you add to that issues of status of where Soviet Union was in the perception in the world arena and where Russia emerged in the 1990s in the world arena, you see very quickly where the source of insecure collective national identity in Russia is located. Now, I mentioned the issue of leadership. So the interesting thing, at least in my brain, happened when I was thinking about the puzzle I started with, happened when I read this book, The New Psychology of Leadership, Identity, Influence, and Power, which was written by social psychologists that suggested that leadership is a process, and it's a process of creating a specific type of relationship where effective leader necessarily contains these attributes that group followers are viewing effective leader as being one of them. The group followers, group members, group inmates, in-group people see leaders as making sense of the group, as promoting group interests and making that group matter. So these four interesting elements that link the group followers and the leaders in a specific type of vision of what that group leader represents for group followers, right? And in the process of building this, in the process of leadership, you also have an intensification, you know, that group formation really happens through leadership, right? So through effective leadership, groups form, and groups do not form without leaders. And so this theory allows to view politicians as identity entrepreneurs because it's about this group belonging and group identity. And it's very interesting how this theory, this social psychology approach, actually allows us to see parallels between leadership patterns of individuals, of politicians in democratic states and in authoritarian states. So here, Donald Trump, for example, could be seen as such an identity entrepreneur that could be compared to Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban, president of Hungary, or Narendra Modi in India. And so it goes beyond regime analysis, but brings to us some intuitive knowledge about how leadership occurs and how there are certain patterns that go beyond the boundaries of authoritarian or democratic systems. And so leadership is about, you know, being an effective manager of this group sense and group belonging and instilling in group members certain ideas about where you as a leader stand. And I guess we can credit many of these individuals with such outcomes that they were able to bring groups behind them. So those are some analytical things that went into the book. Now, in terms of methods in political science, we follow empirical research. We try to not simply suggest something, but we try to see how we can, you know, observe this on the ground. And observing on the ground for me took various types of strategies, but one of them was focus group interviews, where I held four focus group interviews in 2016 in Kazan and Samara, where I tried to see what will happen with my respondents if I prime their national identity. Because in social identity approach, this concept of depersonalization captures the shift that happens when a personal vision of an individual shifts towards his social identity or her social identity. So, you know, I might perceive myself right now as Gulnaz, a Tatar who was born here, who has part of such and such parents, and she's a political scientist, etc. Or I might perceive myself as an American citizen or as a Russian citizen. And what does it do to me at this moment when depersonalization happened, when from being a personal individual, I all of a sudden adopt a group identity? And what happens is that social identity theories predict that individuals tend to converge in their attitudes towards those ideas that they see as shared in the group. So there is this push towards assuming a position of a group prototype. And so my idea was, or my goal was in this focus group interviews, to try to enact a change in identity to see what type of change in attitudes could happen. And the findings were really incredible because I was able to find that when people view when they have policy making preferences of their own as personalities, you know, respondent one, respondent two, respondent three, they're all different, they're all unique. Now, when you ask them about what the policymaking preferences are, they start talking about very mundane things. They want better salaries, better employment opportunities. They want better healthcare, better education for their kids, less corrupt politicians, things that, you know, everyone would share, these socioeconomic governance-based preferences. Now, but if you're able to shift that perception from personal to national level, and you make people think not as respondent one, as respondent two, but as a citizen of Russia, all of the sudden, all their preferences shift towards Russia's status in the world and support for Putin and Putin's popularity based on this perceived securing of national identity that he has done. And I'm going to illustrate it with some quotes from my interviews. So when national identity was not central, people would say, one of the quotes was about basic salary. If you want to earn a bit beyond your basic salary, you leave home in the morning, return at night with no energy. That is, if you don't want to just eat chicken trimmings, basically a complaint about how difficult it is to make ends meet. And if national identity is central, all of a sudden, you have this conversation about how Putin's Russia showed her teeth, how America wanted to fragment Russia, but Putin didn't let that happen, how Putin is a person who saves us from war, how Putin made the West to take us into account. We are respected. The West is afraid of us. Fear means respect. The country's image has grown. Putin has a goal to strengthen the country, to make others respect us. And all popularity of Putin is not linked to personal preferences that individuals have, to the perception that salaries have grown or pensions are paid better or the, you know, healthcare system has improved, but to all these points about Russia's status in the world. Now, the best quote was this one: Putin is not a rocket dragging the country up. Putin is a parachute that prevented Russia from falling and crashing completely. So there is an interesting nuance there of both recognizing that Russia, you know, economy, Russia is not doing very well, and yet Putin provided some soft landing for the country. So the rather nuanced way of crediting Putin with what he's done for the country. So those were the focus group interviews where, you know, my respondents showed that preference orderings that Russian citizens have, and this is actually similar, you know, not only, it's not unique to Russia, that they depend on the varying salience of their identities. So if national identity becomes central to an individual's self-perception, your preference structuring and your, you know, desire to say sacrifice your economic well-being or that of your family to the country's greatness or victory or, you know, things like that could be observed. And there is this shift that happens. And I'm not the only one who came up with this observation. I quote here Karin Nyborg. She is an economist in Norway, environmental economist, who has made some similar arguments for environmental politics. Now, yes, and this is quite different from mainstream approach to public opinion survey, where, you know, usually when political behavior analysts look at public opinion, they think, okay, you know, usually we have pretty stable individual attitudes, and when people get new information, then they change their attitudes. What I was able to show in these focus group interviews is that this shift can occur without additional information, but depending on the salience of whatever identities that come to the front of your mind and to your self-perception. And this is just one. I'll also tell you another sort of empirical method that I used to develop the arguments in the book was, you know, if the focus group interviews showed the outcomes, the results of securing national identity, of making it stronger, and how that is linked to popularity of Putin. I wanted to also see what happens if you insecure national identity, if you make people, if you prompt people thinking that Russian, you know, status in the world is under threat, that it's not recognized, that compared to other countries, Russia is recognized less than others. And I did that by survey experiment where two additional questions were integrated into Levada survey in November 2017. And half of my respondents had these two additional questions, that one of them dealt with the issue of how Ukraine got a visa-free travel to European Union while Russia didn't, and what people think about it. And then the other question was about the upcoming South Korean Olympics in that winter, end of 2017, early 2018. So there was a doping scandal that was taking place, and a Russian Russian Olympic team, it wasn't clear whether it will be allowed or not. And in the end, it was not allowed under Russian flag. So both of these doping scandals and the fact that Ukraine received visa-free travel to the European Union, but Russians didn't, all showed this precarious, insecure, threatened position of Russia. And, the hypothesis was that if Putin relies on securing collective identity to build his legitimacy, then prompting these ideas that Russia is not standing really well in the world would work to reduce his support base. And I'm going to show this graph here, but don't worry about it. I'll just explain what it means. Maybe don't even look at it. It basically means what I found was that in the group that answered these additional questions that made people think that their country might not be so well respected in the world, the choices of who are you going to vote in presidential elections if elections were held to next week. And in November 2017, when this survey was held, there were just a few months before the presidential elections 2018 in March that actually happened. So people were asked, they were given a list of people, politicians, and they were asked, who are you going to vote if the elections were held next March, next week. And so what I found was that those respondents who responded to two additional questions about Russia's status, they tended to give less support, less vote to Putin. And we went out and saw among those other candidates who were on the list, because there were more nationalist and more liberal candidates. More liberal, for example, include Yevlinsky, there was Ksenia Sobchak on the ballots there. And then there were on the other side more nationalists, Zhirinovsky and Zyuganov. And what I found that all the votes that Putin lost went into the nationalist camp of Zyuganov and Zhirinovsky. And this idea basically worked really well with confirmed social identity theories, predictions about what would happen if national identity is insecure. Okay, so when national identity is threatened, individuals shift in their political preferences towards more nationalist politicians. So that I was able to show. So in the end, all these empirical methods helped me basically to articulate the argument of the book that the key solution to this puzzle of post-Crimea euphoria is the Kremlin's national identity politics. And in the book, I work a lot on constructing the context, because it's not just about national identity politics and, you know, whether you prompted this or that way, but how did it happen in Russia? And the identity politics was constructed around a sense of victimhood and ressentiment. These grievances were directed against the West, and they were also underpinned by some important legacies of the Soviet collective identity. And big part of the book focuses on this sense of victimhood, how it was built, on the sense of being surrounded by enemies and how it takes its origins from the Soviet collective identity. And so, and among the legacies of Soviet collective identity, also there is this point about Soviet exceptionalism that was very important as a national consolidation strategy for the Soviet Union that was lost in the 1990s and that we see being recouped by Putin in the 2000s. So basically Putin's image was promoted and presented as that of a leader who has secured Russia. Now, I mentioned legacies of the Soviet collective identity. I point out two important ones. I mentioned Soviet exceptionalism. And this was one of those very much taken for granted ideas that people, Soviet citizens, shared that somehow they belonged to an exceptional state that had all those lofty goals. And this idea was embedded through just a variety of institutions, starting with almost nurseries and kindergarten, and of course in school and in the army and at the workplace. And the other important element was how the Soviet Union was always surrounded by the enemies. So if you look at the Soviet history, starting with the encirclement after the Bolshevik Revolution and then World War II and then Cold War, there wasn't a 5 or 10 years in Soviet history when there was no enemy. So, you know, Soviets always had enemy. In the 1990s, that situation was gone. There was no exceptionalism. There was no sense of enemy, right? And what I'm trying to argue in the book is that Putin has returned these important consolidation elements, partially because it resonates with the Soviet cognitive national identity legacy, but also because it's probably one of the easiest ways for any leader to build, to consolidate community and society around them. If you have enemy, and if you say we're the best and we are morally superior to anyone who surrounds us. The other important two concepts that I use in the book, and here I rely on Vamik Volkan, who is a psychotherapist, who came up with this observation that any society for building these strong bonds of belonging, that any society relies on or needs some sort of chosen glory around which you can build optimism and strength, sense of strength and hope for the future. And also that society needs a chosen trauma, something around which people can coalesce and share as something painful in their history. And so these two things are easily identifiable on the Russian post-Soviet historical landscape. Many scholars have noted the role of World War II and how its political role as a chosen glory has increased through time. And where I came in with maybe more original, also additional observations, was about the chosen trauma. Because what I noticed in Russian propaganda, in the media, I noticed the political significance of how some public opinion leaders were focusing on promoting this idea of 1990s as a trauma. It had its own term, Lihie 90s, but, and indeed society has gone through a very difficult period of, you know, joblessness and inflation and fragmentation and criminality and gangs and war in Chechnya and a lot of different struggles and pains and anarchy, perceived anarchy, very weak state, weak institutions, high corruption, privatization that has been referred as prihvatization or based on theft, the major theft of the 20th century. So there were a lot of traumatic and dramatic elements of that history. But there were also good things that happened in the 1990s with opening up, with political pluralism, with people starting to travel, with journals and books being published, with more interesting school programs and new universities being established and exchange students. A lot of good things happened as well. The interesting thing that happened in 2000s was that the Kremlin and the Kremlin-controlled propaganda machine mythologized the 1990s into this big black hole against which the 2000s were presented as the time of coming out of that big well that people wouldn't want to return to. What was really important for this was the media machine. And if you look at, I just have the photo here of Vladimir Solovyov, a journalist who is hours and hours and hours on Russian TV, especially after 2014. A lot of talk shows under his anchorship are really playing the role of the Rupert of the Kremlin's propaganda, and he's one of the vicious one. I can try to go here. You know, George Orwell, look at Solovyov being put into the costume of someone from the Animal Farm in George Orwell. Actually, this is the figure of Squealer. And I'm going to read just a short quote from, you know, obviously a genius, a brilliant author who in 1945 foresaw how narratives could be built for political legitimation. So in this case here, do you know what would happen if we pigs failed in our duty? And the story there is that the pigs in the farm went through a revolution and took over the farm and became the rulers, while the former farmers under name Jones were kicked out. So here the Squealer, one of the propaganda guy, says, do you know what would happen if we pigs failed in our duty? Jones would come back. Yes, Jones would come back. Surely, comrades, surely there is no one among you who wants to see Jones come back. And then he notes, Orwell says, now, if there was one thing that the animals were completely certain of, it was that they did not want Jones back. When it was put to them in this light, they had no more to say. And this is the strategy that was used, and you know, you can observe it for hours and hours of various programming when Vladimir Solovyov would be dedicating an hour and a half or 2 hours of his time bringing guests in the talk shows and will ask his audience, do you want the 90s to come back? Surely everyone understood that no one wants the 90s to come back, because they were mythologized into something that was perceived as just the most horrible time, out of which Putin brought them back and saved them. So my last slide is about how this line of thinking and this perspective about the political strategy of working and prompting and making national identity salient, how it still applies for understanding what's happening with Russia's war in Ukraine, and how it could be seen as an analytical framework that helps us to make sense of the reality in Russia today. And one simple way to think about this is that war actually works to intensify this strategy, because national identity is central in the context of war that is perceived as existential. If your nation is seen as under threat, your own personal preferences for a better salary or for, you know, again, various other things that you would prefer in peace times become secondary to the desire for your nation to win, to dominate, etc. And war context works to consolidate society behind Putin. One concept that's been developed in political science is rallying around the flag. We saw rallying around the flag after Crimea, and this time we see rallying around the flag not as a euphoria, but as a defensive consolidation of the Russian society that again converges on what they see is the ideas that and preferences that are shared in the society. So a much stronger groupthink. And if we look at Putin's popularity levels, it jumped in 2014 from around low 60s to upper 80s. And the same thing is happening with what we observe when Russia sends troops to Ukraine, and when Putin's popularity that was again in the lower 60s, and again the war brought it right back. So, you know, from my perspective, we can come up with various hypotheses as to how we make sense of this suicidal decision that the Kremlin has done with invading Ukraine in a full-scale war. But social identity theory and leadership approach looked through the social identity theory allows us to also, see this decision as a potential, politically rational decision for a leader to try to stay in power by diverting popular preferences towards group preferences, by making group survival, national survival in this case, important value for and to be shared by everyone. And obviously war does create that context. So from that, if we come from this perspective, it's a bit of a pessimistic view of how for Putin, a situation of long war, delayed resolution is actually something that works in his favor, because it keeps individual preferences out of the picture, and it keeps state preferences, war priorities in the picture upfront for everyone to see and to share. So I think that's pretty much everything that I wanted. Yes, thank you. And I'm open to your questions. Thank you for your attention.
Great, thank you, Gulnaz. So we now enter the question and answer portion of our program. Please submit your questions via the chat function at the bottom of your viewing screen. If you've not done so already, you may turn on your video function now, but please keep yourself muted. And while we're waiting for questions to come in, ICFRC wants to thank its members and donors for their support. If you would like to join ICFRC or make a gift to support its programs, please go to icfrc.org. Okay, and while we're waiting for questions from the viewers, I'll go ahead and pose one, Gulnaz, which is the image of the Russian public is very important in people's thinking about how long can this go on, what are going to be the consequences within Russia for the invasion and the course of the war. And I wonder, you suggest that for many Russians, this is making them more attached to the state. But there's also a number of observers who kind of stress that it's making the Russian public kind of hunker down and become try to guard themselves from those kind of things. As Andrei Kolesnikov, an analyst at the Carnegie Endowment, recently wrote that Russian society has assumed the fetal position. So I'm wondering if that makes sense, or how you see those things playing out within Russian society today.
Yeah, the fetal position is when there is this sort of gathering together, right? Remember how like people can like sleep on their, sort of like all in one ball, right? And so that actually captures it in a good way from the perspective that that's why I mentioned that, after 2014, we saw euphoria and we saw happiness. After the invasion, we see increased anxiety, fears, sometimes even aggression, but that aggression is not directed at the Kremlin. It's frequently directed, interestingly, at those who either, those who have left Russia, they would direct it to those who have stayed in Russia. Those who have stayed in Russia would direct their aggression against those who have left. So anxiety, fear, aggression, shame become some of the key emotions that are experienced in the society today. And so this fetal position expresses those pent-up tensions that are not resolved, and they are not resolved and they're not expressed because of these salience of national identity and because of people's pressure to think in the, to converge with group prototype. You cannot be a traitor to your society, to your motherland, and so you're assumed to support your leader and your country and your army in this war because of that importance of national identity from which people come to see the situation.
Super, thank you. That's helpful. All right, now I'm going to read questions that we're getting from viewers. Even those who don't like the Putin regime certainly would not want a resumption of the Yeltsin-led, Harvard-directed neoliberal 90s. The Russian economy has made a significant comeback under Putin's regime, else why sanction Russia?
What was the question there? Yeah, absolutely. That's about the 90s, right? Why people do not, and how 90s became such a potent instrument in this legitimation strategy that people do not want to go back. But the interesting thing in my focus group interviews, right, if I'll develop it a little bit further, in 2016, while it resonates at the superficial level that the 90s were the worst and Putin has saved us from the 90s and it's better now. But once you go a bit further into discussing what was happening in the 90s, then all of a sudden some people start remembering, oh, it was a time of opportunities. It was so much easier to make money. Now we cannot even imagine. And so a conversation about the 90s, once with people who have lived in the 90s, actually could go in various directions. And it's much more nuanced and rich than what the official narrative suggests.
Great. Do you see a parallel between Xi Jinping of China and Putin as leaders?
Well, I think recently we saw some developments in Chinese politics with Xi Jinping attempting to maybe shift some patterns in how political institutions in China work and to stay in power for longer or without more accountability that Chinese system, communist system did have. So from this perspective of political survival and Xi Jinping's observed desire to stay in power for longer, we do see parallels. But otherwise, Putin's regime has evolved in the direction of very personal dictatorship. And to my understanding, Chinese system is still institutionally a stronger system, although I think we can probably suggest that Xi Jinping was doing some things more recently that to undermine that institutional framework that governed Chinese politics. So there are some parallels that we might see, but again, these are not just two leaders, right? I mean, as we speak, there are a number of individuals, politicians around the world who are trying to stay in power. And so in that perspective could be compared to Putin.
An estimated 200,000 Russian soldiers have died in the Ukraine war. Has this loss registered on the psyche of Russia? Has it changed the shared identity?
Yeah, that's a very important, politically important question, something that needs to be discussed. And what we observe is that these estimated 100 or 200,000 of soldiers frequently were drawn from the poorer parts of Russia because the government tried to present the war as a special military operation that it draws professionals in and pays them handsomely. Those who signed the contracts to go into war, they were promised a lot of money and they went there frequently for that money. And so there was a strong correlation of where the soldiers that signed contracts came from, the poorest areas. Now you can imagine that in these poorest regions and periphery, Russian periphery, the agency, political agency, would be the lowest. And this was noticed already in spring 2022 when I think her name is Valentina Melnikova, who is a well-known civil society leader who has dealt with soldiers' mothers, organizations from the 1990s that were dealing with Chechnya. At that point, society was not so socially separated, segmented, and divided with such a degree of poverty that we do have today, rich versus poor. And at that point in the 90s, mothers of soldiers were more likely to try to do something. And so Melnikova was asking, what happened today? You see mothers just absorbing the tragedy and making it personal instead of politicizing it. And so far, we have not seen a strong social political outburst of emotions and demands associated with all the losses that people have encountered, that families have encountered. And one hypothesis there is that because of which families it is related to, these were frequently the least politically efficacious families. So if say 50,000 of these deaths came to Moscow families or St. Petersburg families, there might have been a greater outcry.
Great. So I have a question about opponents of the war in Russia. And Those who are critical of Putin. Where does this minority fit into the research on Soviet society and national identity that you've talked about?
Yes. So, yeah, it doesn't fit into that aggregate view that I'm presenting. It is a minority, and I should note that it is the minority that has the hardest time today to live in Russia, right? So because, of course, you know, the exit options for people were kept open, the boundaries were open, and those who, the borders, and those who could leave Russia, many people, I mean, there is over a million of exile, right? The immigrants, people who left Russia out of, from the war and then from mobilization. So if you decide, there were people who decided to stay, even if they could leave Russia. And it is the most difficult situation for them because the dominant, there is this converging dominant prevailing opinion. And then you have your personal opinion that, you know, might be shared by a network of people you are connected to, but there is a strong resistance on the ground from the societal, you know, institutions, schools, many other organizations and institutions in the country. So we do see these individualized expressions and even attempts to organize, but these organizations frequently happen like on Telegram channels, you know, and some symbolic actions are done, but we also see very strong repression against, you know, perceived opposition, not even leaders. Sometimes, you know, people are being imprisoned in showcases for reposting something or for suggesting something. So there are quite dramatic cases of repressions that Russian society is facing today.
Great. I think we can end on this question, which raises, I think, a really important question, one that has that people are discussing a lot now in connection with the anniversary of the launching of the invasion. Every war ends eventually. Does your research suggest how to manage provisions for final peace treaty, for example, reparations? That is, how could the war end in a way that would, you know, that would allow Russia not to suffer wounds to its national identity or to, you know, kind of, that would be a stable peace, I guess.
Yeah, this is the, like, the big elephant in the room, right? How does this war end? Now, the sad part is that it doesn't seem that at this moment there is readiness for any sort of negotiation, really, from either side. But, you know, I think there is optimism on the side of Ukraine specifically, but also on the side of Russia, that they can still achieve their objectives and stay on top and win one way or another. I think from the Russian perspective, the desire and the strategy is to slowly squeeze out, you know, using Russian human and resource depth and territorial depth, slowly squeeze Ukrainian army and make, you know, basically show also to the West that Russia cares about Ukraine more than Western countries do, right? And so Putin believes in that, and so he believes in this concept of sort of squeezing slowly. Now, from the Ukrainian side, there is also, with the new weaponry and renewed support and renewed morale that has been strong for the past year, there is also, you know, at least on my side, I'm looking forward to the next few months in terms of what Ukrainian counteroffensive might seem like. So, but the question about how this war can end and what type of scenarios could be offered as a potential win-win situation out of the conflict is a very important one. It's not discussed enough, but it's also, I think, being discussed more underwater in more invisible spheres. At least I've just had in the morning conversation today with one peace resolution scholar who we spent some time, and I think she was involved in had a group, parts of which participated in the negotiations in April, in failed negotiations in March and in April. But being a scholar who focuses on peace negotiations, she was mentioning how with any conflict, there is an opening right in the beginning. And so that opening attempted to come into, but it wasn't realized, it failed. And there will be an opening at some point when either, you know, the sides will not have, will there will be stalemate if the stalemate will be achieved. And so we are not at this moment into a stalemate. My own very intuitive prediction is that let's see what will happen later in summer, because, you know, what, you know, that's my just speculation. You know, I don't know exactly. There is very high level of uncertainty, but I do expect some attempt of the Ukrainian military to make some inroads. It's pretty clear that Russian offensive has been rather slow and stagnant, and again not reaching the objectives that the Russian commanders probably hoped for. And so, but I think the counteroffensive from Ukrainian side is coming, and we'll see how far they might be able, you know, to free their territories. And if they are able to free their territories, that will give them an upper hand in negotiations. So, but that's a big open question, and it's time for peacemakers to really think about various scenarios. What happens if one side, you know, wins, another loses? What happens if there is a stalemate? For any of those outcomes, there should be a certain scenario that can be presented to the two sides as potential, you know, way out of the conflict, ceasefire or armistice. And that's where the conflict resolution scholars and their knowledge, their comparative knowledge, is very, very handy.
Great. Thank you, Gulnaz. So we've been listening to Dr. Gulnaz Sharafutdinova, and we thank her for her excellent presentation. This was ICFRC's sixth program for the spring semester. Our next program will be on Wednesday of next week, February 28th at 12 noon Central Standard Time via Zoom. It will feature speakers Saadat Ahmadi and Zainab Afghan, and they will speak on Cedar Rapids Afghan community, 18 months on from the U.S. withdrawal. Thank you for joining us, everyone. We are adjourned.